This is lecture number 8. And to give the rest of the 8 a story, to give us the full coherent states, we appeal to our one-dimensional situation. This is the one-dimensional set of coherent states. Expectation value equal to 1, that's the analog of this statement. Expectation value of D equal to 0 is the analog of that statement. These were pure algebraic consequences. And then we had to give the full overlap matrix that determines uniquely, up to a phase actually, what the eta vector really is by the GNS reconstruction. And we chose this particular form. I said it had been chosen from the fact that this was a minimum uncertainty state. It was an extremal weight vector, had all those good properties that we were used to for the canonical coherent states. And more to the point, it was analytic. Q double prime inverse and beta double prime over times I over beta was a complex conjugate combination which we will find valuable for us. Indeed, if you remember how wave functions are defined for the reproducing kernel Hilbert space, that is to say, this is the reproducing kernel, and you sum with coefficients with weighted components of this, then the analytic property of this will continually be remained. Every function that you make that way is connected, going to be still analytic. Okay, here is the formula for the full coherent state on 4-7. I'm going to try to keep on this last equation from 4-6 on the same time, because I want you to compare these two. Beta here and here has become B of X. B of X appears here as a power. This one is expressed as exponential with logarithms. That could be done well here. And B of X also appears here in the denominator, just like the beta appears. Here we have a difference of the two P's. Here we have a difference of the two pi's. Here we have a sum of the two inverses. Here we have a sum of the G inverses. The G's we will call the lower indices, so these are the inverse elements. These are the combinations up here which account for normalization. This is the pair of fellows that count for normalization is here. I want to point out... Yes, there surely is. Thank you so much. There's a curly bracket missing here. Thank you very much. And so I want to point out some things about this. Of course, the first thing to notice is the absolute similarity with this quantity. If I put this expression into e to the natural log of that, and then invert it with a minus sign so that this was in the numerator, this was in the denominator, it would have a form exactly parallel to what that is. Notice several things about this. First off, it depends on a function B of X, which is a scalar density by my choice. And it has the dimensions length to the minus 3. So that takes care of the length question, dimensional questions here, and takes care of the transformation properties of that object. Since this is a tensor and this is a tensor density, I want to divide by a density so that I can get these two things into transformation properties of similar character. Different B of X will actually correspond to inequivalent field operator representations. That's a pretty big, tall order to deal with, different inequivalent field operator representations, but since we're doing quantum field theory, we have to face up to that story. B of X is something I've had to put in. Remember, I'm doing quantization first, reduction second. Quantization first means I don't even use the constraints of gravity. I don't bring them in. They will come in the next transparency or so. But right now, I've had to quantize first and choose some representation. It's not going to be the right representation. So when the true representation is chosen, which I will be unable to do for you because that's a very complicated problem, then this quantity B of X will change, do something else, and the correct representation will come in. Important thing to observe is that the right-hand side, our definition here, does not depend on the 9 variables which appear in gamma, that's 3 times 3, but appears in the 6 variables that make up the G. G is a 3 by 3 symmetric matrix. How does that come about? Well, let's go back quickly to our definition of the coherent states on the top of 4, 6 here. This is an action first on the eta. Suppose this had been the rotation group, just the J's, the 3 J's that you're familiar with, and this had been a rotationally invariant state, then this would have made no contribution whatsoever here. So what is actually happening is this eta is chosen so that it's picking out parts of the gamma to depend on, but not all of the gamma. And the parts it depends on are just those which are represented by G. Okay, so that's an important ingredient. And the way this is structured means that the coherent states actually depend on G and not on gamma, not the full 9 of these, but only the 6. So hereafter we will call the coherent states pi and G as labeled. Observe that this has a canonical appearance. These are the 6 momentum variables, and these are the 6 coordinate variables in their inverse form. And that's a perfectly canonical statement. Although we have not started with a canonical theory. We started with our affine commutation relations, the 9 operators pi hat AB and the 6 G. Nevertheless, in our choice of the fiducial vector and everything else that will follow from it, we have the appearance of a canonical theory. Furthermore, this equation is invariant under spatial coordinate transformations. If I make a spatial coordinate transformation, I get a matrix multiplying the front and the back of this due to the coordinate transformation. The same matrix appears here and here and here, the scalar density character being canceled out. And that will cancel with the matrices down here, and this is an invariant volume, so this is a quantity which is invariant under coordinate transformations. Now, functional integrals is something we talked about in one of our lectures in principle. But it is also a very valuable way to look at how expressions come about. And so we're going to try to turn this into a functional integral representation. For that, let's start again by going to ask for help from our single degree of freedom situation. Let's go back to the single degree of freedom situation for a moment and look at the coherent state representation in the affine coherent states. That's the PQ inner product with the abstract vector psi, giving us the function psi of P and Q. I made a point to you already of saying that this is analytic in the combination Q plus I P divided by beta. That's up to a factor because that factor is for a normalization. We want to make this a normalized state. Well, you know that anything that's analytic, say it's a function of Z, then you find the Cauchy-Riemann equations by taking the derivative with respect to Z star and asking it to be zero. So all we have to do is to observe that since this is a function of this up to the right factor, we fix the factor situation, and we find there is a first order differential equation that every one of these representatives satisfy. That's called a polarization. If you're in the language of geometric quantization, they introduce the concept of polarization to reduce the number of functions in the Hilbert space spanned by these things. So all of these satisfy this first order differential equation, every representative. Well, we can take a good advantage of that. We're still under the help rule here, number 4.8. And we observe that if B is actually zero on those functions, then certainly B dagger B up to a constant here, we'll call that capital A. This is actually a non-negative operator. And moreover, A on every one of those functional representatives in that Hilbert space vanishes. Well, we can put that to use for us by putting that up in an exponent, e to the minus nu t A. T will play the role of a time in a short moment. Nu is our parameter we like to use sometimes for nu going to infinity. As nu goes to infinity, acting on the delta function, that will project out of that everything that is not part of the A equals zero subspace. So we get a kernel out of that limiting form, which is a projection operator kernel onto the zero subspace of capital A. But the coherence state overlap that we is of interest to us is indeed itself proportional to this same kernel. Therefore, pi, this quantity that we get this way, is proportional to our kernel of interest. And indeed, we're now going to insert a Feynman-Kotz-Stratonovich representation. Well, this is a first-order operator for B. B dagger B for A is then a second-order differential operator. Second-order differential operator is like a Hamiltonian in quantum mechanics. That Hamiltonian can be given a Feynman-Kotz prescription. Here is the kinetic energy of the particles in that story. Here is the interaction with the magnetic field that comes along with that. This is kind of like we talked about this before when we used the quantum Hall effect as an analogy to find a functional integral representation for this quantity. Here all we need to do is use the straightforward Feynman-Kotz Stratonovich prescription. What is Stratonovich for? He's there to give a definition to this stochastic integral. This is Brownian motion, not on a plane, because these are not Cartesian coordinates. This is Brownian motion on a space of constant negative curvature. The curvature is actually minus 1 over 2 beta here. And, it's minus 2 over beta. And so we can make good use of the Brownian motion by introducing a proper pin Brownian motion. Here is a formula for stochastic differential, stochastic integral in proper mathematics. Here is the right numerical prefactor. And this limit of this well-defined functional integral will give us our overlap. So that's an expression for that. Well, we can do the same thing for the gravity case. The gravity case, I should remind you, if it wasn't clear before, the gravity case is likewise a function of an analytic variable. Here's g double prime plus I over b times pi double prime. So this is a function of an analytic variable, just as the elementary one-dimensional example was. Put that to use for us. Use the same kind of trick we've just done, and we come up with a functional integration representation for the coherent state function overlap in the case of the gravity case. Well, we have a qp dot, a minus qp dot. Here it is, minus qp dot form. We have a measure that's weighting under there. Here it is, the measure weighting under here. And here's the integration over all the p's and all the q's in the appropriate field case. Now, you could write this down as a typical functional integral, and you would normally be led to something like that. I push that pen up a little bit here. So that you have the phase, the kinematical part, and the integration over those. Who is to tell you? Who is to tell you how to define that? I'm saying that this integral expression has not been written down out of the air, as I guarantee you that most functional integrals are. This is written down as a solution to the equation that this satisfies, namely the analog of this capital A that we had at the top of that page, I think, still there, right there, is the analog to this equation. This is a derived equation. Moreover, just as there is a bona fide measure underlying this integral here, which I call the Wiener measure on the space of constant negative curvature, there is a bona fide measure underlying this integral, which is given by this expression, an analog of Brownian motion, extended in spatial directions as well, this integration term. And of course, I can't put it in such elegant form because this is not a suitable integrand for this because I have an infinite number of degrees here. But if I put in some cutoff in here, then this proper definition of that integral could be perfectly well be given. Moreover, what about the domain of integration here? The domain of integration is restricted to the region of absolute physical interest, where the 3x3 matrix G, A, B, is always a positive definite matrix. For one thing, this form of the measure here, the form of the metric, sorry, the metric here, and in both cases, forces the variables to stay away from Q equals to zero. Here, Q, this is Q to the minus two. This situation, this metric up here has, as I think I said once before, it has complete geodesics on the half space. This is the Poincaré half plane. And similarly down here, so that this is completely fulfilled within the proper physical regime. And I certainly have already emphasized the similarities with the single degree of freedom situation. Okay, so we have our kinematics. We have our first form of the Hilbert space, both given by the overlap of the coherent states and now given as a functional integral representation. What we need to do next is to study constraints. Try to put in a projection operator appropriate to the constraints. So we have classical diffeomorphism constraint in page 4.9 and classical temporal constraint or Hamiltonian constraint. And somehow they are made into operators over here. And ideally, following the Dirac ideas, you would like to have those operators act on physical vectors to be zero, and that would fulfill the constraints. Let's see if that's a possibility in this particular case. So we ask if the time derivative of these can be true. Time derivative involves the constraint commutator, so let's look at that family. HA, HB, commutator is proportional to HA, HB again, just like the classical Poisson brackets were. HA commutator with capital H, proportional to capital H. So these first two would be just fine. But if this is actually zero and this is actually zero, then the commutators satisfy the situation because that would be zero and that would be zero. However, it's the last commutator which gives us the trouble. Temporal constraint at X, temporal constraint at Y commutator is proportional to the diffeomorphism constraints and also the metric. And since the metric and the diffeomorphism constraints do not commute, I must symmetrize the right-hand side in order to have the proper hermeticity situation. So if I now bring up one of these presumed vectors of Mr. Dirac on the right-hand side of this here and here, when it saw this H, it would be happy because it's already supposed to be zero there, but when it sees this G first, as it must, that will knock it out of the physical Hilbert space. And therefore, we have trouble. That's called an anomaly. We have changed our initial first-class constraints classically into partially second-class. And here is a little analog of that situation. If you take Q and P equal to zero, okay, it looks like just two simple constraints, but the commutator of that is proportional to the identity operator, and that simply says there is no solution that satisfies those two constraints. That's the second-class constraint situation. As I say, it's an anomaly because it arises not from the classical, but in the process of quantization. And at this point, ladies and gentlemen, I inform you that most workers change the theory. They give up on this approach because they don't quite know how to handle second-class constraints that appear in the quantum theory. If it was in the classical theory already, they would say, okay, we solve for them first, eliminate them, then we don't need to see them again in the quantum theory. Okay, but the projection operator method I've tried to sell you doesn't care, has no fear of second-class constraints, and so we will accept the quantum constraints as given, and we will live with these commutators. So what do we do? I'm going to introduce a complete set of orthonormal functions. Now these are not quite your everyday orthonormal functions, but they're pretty close. I'm going to use my function B, which was my scalar density, which is non-negative everywhere, is actually positive everywhere, to make something here which is covariant, a volume element under coordinate changes, and say that these guys satisfy this orthogonality under integration like that, and that I take the sum of the two H's, multiply it by a B again to get a density on the right-hand side, and that makes my density on the left-hand side. So that's just a slight modification of traditional orthonormality. With that, I will transform my constraint functions into a sequence of constraint operators, a sequence. So this HA of X is then integrated against the HN of X. This is already a density, so I don't need to introduce the B. That gives me a set for N equals 0 to infinity of the constraint operators. I'll do the same thing for the temporal constraint, map those operators at every point by this technique into a sequence of functions. And then you remember in the projection operator approach, the sum of the squares of the projection operators, quantum projection operators, was the important thing to focus on. And I will arbitrarily define the sum of interest to me as 2 to the minus n, the sum of these operator squares. Why 2 to the minus n? Well, I don't really care. You can have anything else that will converge fast because each of these is supposed to be 0. And how they go to 0 is not so strictly important. In fact, the E that I create here with a delta squared, if I didn't have this 2 to the minus n, if I just had that sum, that might be an infinite multiple of that delta squared. So let me simplify my life by just putting these down here. Now, I tell you, there is a suitable measure on the Lagrange multipliers. This is the shift function and the lapse function. Lagrange multipliers, so that this R function here, which will contain the idea that there's a 2 to the minus n, it will contain the idea that there is this set of HNs involved, etc., etc., that I can find such an R which will take this quantity here, the integrand, and I tell you, the integrand knows nothing about the 2 to the minus n or the HNs. Nevertheless, that integrand can be transformed into the projection operator of interest to me. Okay. Such an expression for the decomposition of the projection operator can be used in forming the functional integral. So we put the projection operator now in between my two coherent states. This will be the reproducing kernel for the physical Hilbert space. The physical Hilbert space, of course, wherein I have a regularization still to be discussed on how small it has to be made. But in the meantime, I have a preliminary physical Hilbert space reproducing kernel given as an integral, path integral, functional integral representation. And this differs only from the one we had before without the E by the appearance of the shift function and the lapse function times appropriate symbols, the scene number representatives for the class quantum diffeomorphism operator and the scene number representative for the quantum temporal constraint. Why aren't these things just the classical quantities? Because there's H bar still around. H bar is not zero. And of course there may be some kind of counter terms. We have to discuss how to define the theory properly. But nevertheless, here's an integral over the dynamical variables or the canonical variables, even though the integral was not defined by a canonical construction. Integration over the Lagrange multipliers. And you can see the ingredients here. We had at one point that this was the classical form, basically, for the Einstein action. So these are quantities are symbols for the quantum operators, and they are H-bar augmented functions, which we simply, unfortunately, are unable to know at this point. What can we say about those functions? Well, ideally, I would like them so that at least as H-bar went to zero, I would recover the classical diffeomorphism. And for the temporal situation, as H-bar went to zero, I would recover the classical temporal constraint. But there's, of course, millions of functions that will have this property, and how do I know which one to choose? For that, I have to know what to choose for the operator constraints. They also include HBAR-dependent counter terms. And before I can find these symbols, that's what the S is supposed to stand for, these symbol terms here, I will actually have to know what the counter terms, etc. Well, that brings us to a whole new kettle of terms, a whole new complication of terms. What are the counter terms for quantum gravity? Quantum gravity is in the category of a non-renormalizable quantum field theory. There are other non-renormalizable quantum field theories, which are simpler, have less indices, less complications. There's no metrics that have to be preserved. The GAB doesn't have to be positive, things like that. So let's look at some scalar models, and we're going to focus on what I like to talk about, the hardcore picture of non-renormalizability. I'm going to try to help you understand what non-renormalizability is, why it arises, and what perhaps we can do about it. Now, this was the subject also of my lecture in March in this room, facing the other way, because it was a chalkboard talk. But of course, none of you remember anything from that, so we'll give you the following overview. Let's take a Euclidean path functional integral formally written for a free theory where W0 is present here, and the 0 signifies free. And for an interacting theory where lambda is a positive number and I have a potential, a V, that I add into my action here. Let's look at these two quantities by themselves. I'm going to argue about letting lambda go to 0. Lambda goes to 0 from this expression, surely looks like that top expression. Now I'm going to show you that you shouldn't believe everything you see. Let's introduce a function capital X of phi, which is defined as unity if W0 of phi for that particular field history, W0 of phi is finite and V is finite. And I'm going to say chi X is 0 if W0 of phi is finite but V happens to be infinite. Okay, so the support of this first integral here, roughly speaking, is in the region where W0 is phi, W0 of phi is finite. The support of the second integral is where W0 of phi is finite and V is finite because lambda is positive. And when V is infinite, that is, since lambda is positive, that suppresses any contribution from that path. So I can freely insert capital X inside this second integral here, on the line, if you will. So as lambda of h is again the same expression, but I put in capital X, because when this is 0 from here, it's already 0 because of the V. And now, two possibilities emerge. If capital X of phi is identically 1, that is to say, if W0 of phi being finite implies that V is finite, and there are such situations, then at X is simply 1, and as lambda goes to 0, S of lambda will go to the free theory. The non-renormalizable cases, and I can make a valid case for this situation, are those for which capital X is not 1, not identically 1. There are places where capital X is 0 in the region of support where W0 would have normally liked to contribute. In that case, when this is not identically 1, then setting lambda to 0 leaves the X behind. That will define something else we'll call S0 prime, which is qualitatively different from S0. What's that got to do with gravity? Well, you can analyze gravity in the same language, take the quadratic terms and the non-quadratic terms, and you can decide that the X appropriate to gravity is also not identically 1. So that shows its non-renormalizable character. Okay, what do we really know today about the quartic scalar field in 5 space-time dimensions? Not 4, That's the strictly renormalizable case. But in five space-time dimensions, that's where it begins to be non-renormalizable. So here is the specific Euclidean theory for this situation. H-phi is a kind of handle, as we've seen in the previous transparency, integration D5 now. This is our W0, a particular grad phi quantity squared plus a certain mass, doesn't matter too much which one. And here is our interaction, our V, which is lambda phi to the fourth. If we do perturbation theory on this quantity, that is to say we regularize things by putting in a high momentum cutoff, calling it lambda, then a graph of this kind, of four vertex, a four vertex, four vertex, four vertex, is proportional to the following. In the numerator, we have two loops, so we have two loops and five dimensions of integration. In the denominator, we have one, two, three, four, five propagators. Each propagator gives us a p squared, and there's five of those. So this is p to the 10 over p to the 10, which becomes a logarithm of the cutoff. That means we need a term with six legs in our counterterm as a term phi to the sixth. If I borrow that phi to the sixth and use it again, because it's now in the theory, here's an example of yet another case where I now have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 legs. That also is divergent. That means I need a term with phi to the 8, and so on and so on. I need and have an infinite number of counterterms. That's the perturbation story. This is the regularization by lattice story. Let's put this on a lattice. So here's what a lattice looks like. It's hypercubic with a lattice spacing called little a. We have five dimensions of a to the fifth is our substitute for this small differential here. A cubed because we have two derivatives. This is my notation for the derivative summation, etc. M0, we let it be a function of the cutoff. Lambda 0, we let it be a function of the cutoff, etc. And what do we know, thanks to Eisenman and Frohlich? We know that in the continuum limit, this quantity goes to a free theory. H of x, u is what I'm calling the integrand here, h of y, it starts with a non-quadratic term in the integrand, but it ends up to be quadratic. It's like a central limit theorem in which probabilities somehow catch hold of the Gaussian limiting behavior. Okay, now, what about the hardcore picture? The hardcore picture would say, if we were serious about applying it, that there should be terms up here where this integration is finite, but this term for the V actually is infinite. And here is the answer. Yes, that is true. Here is the W0. Here is the V. All I need to do is illustrate for you one of a family. You can think there's many. There are many. Fields for which this first integral is finite, the second integral is infinite, and here's the answer. One answer, e to the minus x squared takes care of infinity, and a singularity x to a power p, where p lies between the number 5/4 and 3/2. 5/4 and 6/4. So, you can add these, you can do lots of things, there's tons of these things. And those are cases in which the hardcore would be present. So what happens? When you do a perturbation theory, you're bringing something that is infinite up here, you're bringing it down to the lines. No wonder it's causing you trouble after trouble after trouble. Each power of that is getting more and more severe. No wonder you need an increasing number of counterterms. What about the lattice regularization? Well, the lattice regularization doesn't even attempt to take into effect the possible hardcore nature of this. It's actually quite interesting that on the lattice, when I take the mass term, sum of the phi squared, and the interaction term, sum of the phi fourths, if I square this mass term here, that's to say the sum of phi squared, then that will actually be larger than this term, sum of the phi x to the fourth, because it contains those terms plus actually extra terms, cross terms as well. So that would seem to appear that this is controlled by that. But in the continuum life, that's false. Okay. So this doesn't know about the hardcore, and the other one up there is mistreating the hardcore. And that's why we have these difficulties. Well, I can't solve that problem. I can't solve the relativistic flight of the fourth, but I can solve some other problems which have similar kinds of issues. Now, these are not physical problems. These are mathematical problems. These are designed to illustrate a point. Here's an example. Here's our starting place for our Euclidean functional integration. I put an I in here because that's the way I did it in research, rather than take away the I. But the I is not important at all. So what have I taken away? I've taken the gradient squared. My goodness, of course, I've taken something terrible and done that to a relativistic theory. I've taken the gradient away. But it's not intended to be a physical model. It's intended to show the point that can you study this integral? Can you actually solve that integral? Can you show that it has a hardcore effect? And I say the answers are all yes. In point of fact, this integral, if you treat it traditionally, if you treat it by putting it on a lattice, it is automatically going to go to a Gaussian answer, because that is where the central limit theorem is really very correct statement about this situation. However, if you allow for liberalization in your interpretation, allow for potential counterterms that are not present in the clear so-called classical action that we have available, then you can come up with an answer like this. What is B? B is a necessary dimensional factor. There is a connection between the bare mass m0 squared and the, let's call it the physical mass parameter, m squared over here. They are proportional to each other, but they have a divisor by the delta function, the spatial delta function evaluated at the origin. Of course, that's a huge division by infinity. So that makes this thing exceedingly small. Okay, but in the same time, it changes dimensions because the delta has dimensions. You know that integration delta with dx should be 1, so delta has the inverse dimension. So I need a parameter with dimensions to cancel those dimensions so that the mass parameters will stay the same. How big is B? Unknown. That's one of the parameters of the theory. But here it appears here. B times dnx is dimensionless right there. Everything else is dimensionless. This is du over absolute u, so that any dimensions of u would disappear. Lambda 0 is even worse. That's b cubed times lambda divided by delta 0 of q. But this is a well-defined integral on the right-hand side. It has a perfectly defined perturbation series in lambda about this result here. But what happens as lambda goes to 0? I invite you to look at that expression. As lambda goes to 0, I will cancel it there, and I will cancel it in the second line. You can see in the first line, the integrand appears superficially Gaussian. It does appear superficially Gaussian, but to accept a Gaussian answer for this is accepting the fact that there should be no counterterms. Well, that's incorrect. This is the correct limiting form as lambda goes to 0. This is the S0 prime that we had on the previous transparency where the hardcore is present. Okay, well, that's a model whose answer I can give to you in one line, and I can describe it to you pretty easily. Here's another model, phi dot squared. So I add something back into this. I now drop out the spatial gradients of that, but I keep the time derivative in there. This, too, is a model which, when looked at on a lattice, would give you a Gaussian. It's also non-renormalizable. It's obviously non-renormalizable because it has less in its propagator to save it than the traditional relativistic case does, but it's nevertheless soluble. I can't give you the answer here, but I can point you to a nice book, quantum field theory book written, published first in 2000. Now the paperback edition is out in 2005, called Beyond Conventional Quantization. The purpose of this book is not to solve everybody else's quantum field theory, This is to solve what I consider to be insoluble problems. That is, in my opinion, an insoluble problem. That is an insoluble problem. I'm offering 4,000 Norwegian crowns if you find alternative solutions to either of those. Okay, again, in this story here, when the lambda 0 goes to 0, that is not given by the Gaussian answer here. The presence of the hard core makes itself felt. Well, what is the lesson to be drawn so far? Obviously, I'm not about to give you a full story about quantum gravity. That's a very incredibly difficult problem. But I claim that the hardcore picture has merit. And these are soluble problems outside of perturbation theory. There's sufficient symmetry in these problems, because I've dropped certain terms here, sufficient symmetry in that you can solve these problems outside of perturbation theory. And finding those solutions with these properties of the hard core and the fact that it behaves as advertised gives me the hope and the belief that similar ideas can be applied to the relativistic scalar field theory in the non-renormalizable regime, where, for example, phi to the fourth in five and more dimensions, and hopefully with gravity itself. And with that, my dear colleagues, I will conclude my series of 8 lectures, and thank you very much for your attention.
So just a remark, I will tell you that I ordered this book from Amazon, and it was promised to get here on November the 7th, which I think is before you leave.
It's before I leave.
Okay, so then we will have a signing ceremony.
Okay, I'm out of town. I'm out of town November 7, 8, and 9, but I will be back for signing ceremony.